The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wiggison. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wiggison.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. I'm going to shorten our front-end load here so that we can have more time with Dr. Zubrin, who is our guest tonight. But if you do want to give us a call and talk to Bob, the toll-free number is 866-687-7223. And you can, of course, use email drspace@thespaceshow.com. I also want to remind everybody that The Space Show is a nonprofit, listener-supported radio program. And again, I remind you that if you like what you hear and talking to the guest and having exchanges with them and participating in our program, please do support us. Remember, as a nonprofit, if you're a federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. As for your state deduction, check that out with your state. We're still a California nonprofit, but that will probably be changing within the next 60 days to a Nevada nonprofit. But we do need your support. We have sponsors, and also, if you don't want to be a sponsor but want to do a billboard type of advertisement, you can do that. We have banner ads going across our homepage, and on the longer formatted shows, I read sponsor messages. On the shorter format, and since this is a variable format show, I simply shout out to our great sponsors for their support, because we wouldn't be doing the show without them. Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, ASTROX, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. If this program interests you, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So Dr. Robert Zubrin, Bob Zubrin, is back with us. He really doesn't need an introduction, but in case somebody out there is new to the Space Show or is not familiar with Bob, he's an author with incredible books about how to do Mars and a lot of other things. He's got the Mars Society, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. They've got a phenomenal design contest going. Plus, they have their big conference, which you should know about, in Tempe, Arizona. That's Phoenix, toward the end of October. And we will talk about that too. But Bob wrote an article a couple of weeks ago. It's on the Mars Society website and elsewhere. How to search for life on Mars. First, stop refusing to look. Sounds logical, Bob. Welcome back to the Space Show. Why don't they look?
Okay. So first of all, this article was co-authored with me, Steve Benner, and Jan Spacek. Steve Benner is an extremely eminent astrobiologist, and he's an extremely eminent biologist. He is the first person to synthesize a gene, basically created the field of synthetic biology. And he also made some headlines earlier this year that showing that RNA can form spontaneously on basalt. And this may be why RNA is the information molecule of life, because it's a suitable molecule that forms spontaneously in nature.
Okay. Interesting.
Anyway, so Steve, I, and Jan wrote this article, which was published in the New Atlantis, which is a major journal of science policy, and a link to it is on the Mars Society website. And it's really a very strong piece. Number one, NASA says that the reason why Mars is so important for exploration is because it's the key to discovering the truth about the prevalence and diversity of life in the universe. And that is true, but that is not what NASA is doing on Mars. Okay, NASA's robotic Mars program, which is real, is, however, really ordered towards geologic exploration, which is useful background for a search for life on Mars, but it is not the search for life on Mars. And the human program basically doesn't exist, and to the extent there are plans for it, they're not science-driven missions of any kind. You know, for instance, their current baseline plan involves a 30-day stay on Mars, which means no serious exploration. It means they're not going to Mars with humans to explore. And furthermore, both the robotic program and the envisioned human program avoid the sites where life is most likely to be found. Okay? And that is because of their so-called planetary protection rules. And it is because of the planetary protection rules, which even complicate robotic life detection missions, that there have been no life detection missions sent to Mars in almost half a century. That is, the only one that's been sent was Viking in 1976. And the Curiosity rover was actually redirected to avoid certain regions where it was suspected that there were some liquid water seeps reaching the surface, which would have been a prime location to go to look for life or biomarkers produced by life. And it was ordered to avoid them in order to conform to planetary protection imperatives. Now, so a significant part of the article, it debunks planetary protection. Okay, now there are two forms of planetary protection that are being discussed. The demagogues are engaged in stoking of fears over back contamination, that is, taking the Red Death from Mars and bringing it to Earth. Okay, and there are some even demanding that the Mars sample return mission be stopped because of this danger. Alleged danger, and there was an article that was might have even been in Scientific American by Leonard David that interviewed some individuals spouting this nonsense. And then there's the other kind of planetary protection, which has proponents in the scientific community, but should not, which says we want to avoid bringing life to Mars because it would ruin the science. Okay, now, first of all, as far as the back contamination, which is the one that makes headlines, it's total nonsense. First of all, there's about 500 kilograms of Martian rocks land on Earth every year. And that's been going on for billions of years. And in fact, if you go back further into the past, it was much more than that because the rate of interplanetary transfer was faster in the past. And what we know from actually studies of the Allen Hills meteorite, because of its controversy, was studied very intensely, it was proven that large parts of that meteor had never been raised above 40 centigrade during its entire career of ejection from Mars, flight through space, reentry, and landing on Earth, which means that there had been bacteria in it, they would have survived the trip. So if the Red Death could come from Mars, it already had. And this idea that we need to do heroic measures to quarantine samples coming from Mars makes about as much sense as the Border Patrol being ordered to inspect the trunks of cars of people coming from Canada to make sure no one is importing Canada geese into the United States. Okay, when meantime, millions of them are flying across the border everywhere on their own power. So that's the situation there. And furthermore, it's all just nonsense anyway, because there couldn't be any pathogens on Mars because there's no macrofauna or macroflora on Mars for it to be adapted to infest, let alone of Earth type. So it's all nonsense. But the other one, which is more influential, is that we can't contaminate Mars. And by the way, if this idea is allowed to stand, it rules out human missions to Mars entirely, okay? Because it is impossible even to run a completely successful human mission to Mars without releasing bacteria onto the Martian surface. And it's certainly impossible to rule out such an eventuality if the lander was to crash, in which case you've got biota spread all over the Martian surface. But the idea that humans or robotic instruments must be sterilized in order to search for life on Mars is nonsense. We do biology on Earth without sterilizing the Earth. And on Mars, look, as the article points out, if there's an indigenous Martian microbe, there's three possibilities. One is it has a different biochemistry than Earth life, in which case there's no problem with it's impossible to mistake that for something you brought from Earth, okay? Secondly, it has the same biochemistry from Earth life, but is a novel form that we've never seen before on Earth. That also would be something that you know you didn't bring from Earth. Well, finally, what if you encounter microbes on Mars that are exactly the same as those that we see commonly on Earth? How would you know if you brought them or if they were native? Well, it's simple. If they're native, they will have left residues. They will have left waste. They will have left fossils. They will have left other biomarkers. That's how we know there was life on Earth before we were here. And similarly, if there's life on Mars before the arrival of astronauts, even if it's identical to terrestrial life forms, if we find residues that we can date to before our arrival, which we certainly could if it was there before our arrival, we would know they were native. On the other hand, if we find life on Mars that is absolutely identical to Earth life and there are no residues indicating they were there before us, then we brought them. That's all there is to it. But if, but by promoting this thing, if we can't go to Mars because it would ruin the science, they are ruining the science. I mean, we know the most about life on Earth because we are here. Okay? That's why we know the most. We would know much less if we were not here, and even less if we're not only were not here, but we're banned from sending instruments into areas where the life might be. So this is really an anti-science cult, and it's got to be taken down to do proper robotic science on Mars, and it has to be taken down to ever allow humans to go to Mars. And then furthermore, if you are going to send humans to Mars, you don't want to go at minimum stay, and you don't want to avoid all the most biologically interesting areas. In fact, what you want to do is use robots to identify the most biologically interesting areas and send humans there. Because once you identify the prime targets, you send your best possible investigators, and that is astronauts.
So the way I'm looking at this is, and I'm on your side. I understand this, and I concur with you. But there's a lot of people that don't, and there's a lot of people in powerful positions that don't. So how do you, using your own words, take down this kind of a cult? How do you change it? What do you do?
It intellectually, it's utter nonsense. And frankly, the scientists who are saying it know that it's nonsense. They're just saying it because they know that it's NASA's party line. And it's just like in the Soviet Union. If you want to be acceptable, you must spout the party line, however nonsensical it might be.
Before we go too much further, you did get a pre-show email from a gentleman named Paul who is touching on this. So some of this you've already answered, but I'm gonna go ahead and read it because it illustrates this. Why, in your opinion, hasn't NASA sent the life detection experiment since Viking? Both Viking label release investigators Gil and Patricia claimed that their Viking experiment detected microbial activity. Dr. Levin presented this and did all he could to influence missions, but never got anywhere with it. The most important question about Mars has been ignored for 46 years, but they were also opposed to Earth-Mars sample return as too risky to our biosphere. And I can tell you, Bob, I hear from this all the time because people and their reaction to what happened with COVID and the pandemic, they're scared. They don't want to bring a foreign thing back onto Earth because of what happened with COVID. And then he's asking you to comment. So you've already done some of this, but how do you put it in perspective of the pandemic that we're going through?
All right. Okay, look. There is no object on Earth that is not more biologically hazardous than rocks from Mars. Okay? That is, you know, look, if you go and dig in your garden, you're bringing up material from the Earth's past. And, in fact, we know that there were plagues in the Earth's past. Okay?
Uh-huh.
You go and you dig a hole in your garden, you're bringing up material from the year 1347 when the Black Plague killed a third of the population of Europe. Okay? There is nothing you can do. You know, the reports that warn about back contamination from Mars contain bacteria, including deadly disease bacteria, whereas Martian material can't. Okay? Because there are no macrofauna, no animals, no plants on Mars that are there to be hosts. Look, we were able to get COVID from bats because bats are mammals and they're relatively closely related to us. No one has ever caught a disease from a tree. And believe me, a pine tree is going to be much closer related to you than any organism on Mars. So humans can get diseases from other humans and occasionally from other mammals and even birds. But, I'm unaware of anyone ever getting it from amphibians, and certainly not from plants. And disease organisms are adapted to hosts. A, there are no hosts on Mars, and B, if there were, they wouldn't be as closely related to us as trees. And C, if there were disease organisms on Mars who could get here, they already have. Because once again, okay, billions of tons of Martian material have already been flown to Earth. Okay? A kilogram of material from Mars landed on Earth today. Okay, so NASA is talking about bringing a kilogram or two or three from Mars. When this year 500 kilograms are going to be landed from Mars, and once again, not under the control of any authorities. So this is just crazy. It's crazy.
You have a caller. Let's see what your caller wants to say to you. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. And who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is David from Leander, Texas.
Okay.
I know that Dr. Zubrin is big in nuclear physics as well as Mars exploration. My question, and this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, is a lot of people on nuclear are worried about the waste problem. Could we simply put all of the nuclear waste from the U.S. onto starships and send it to Mars, reprocess it, and then use that to bootstrap a Martian economy?
Well,
I mean, it would take 1,000 starships, but that's kind of what Elon is talking about anyway.
Well, look, the only reason why nuclear waste is an issue, but the waste from coal-fired power plants is not, is because, you know, there's been maybe 1,000 tons of nuclear waste produced in the world, in the whole history of the world, and there's been, you know, millions, maybe billions of tons of coal fire. In other words, that nuclear waste is only an issue because it's solvable as opposed to waste from coal, which is not. So now you don't want to send nuclear waste to Mars. Initially, you want to send nuclear fuel to Mars because it's a very good power source. But to reprocess nuclear waste is certainly possible, but it requires a significant industrial base, which we have. We could do it, and we could There's a great deal of energy content in nuclear waste. The caller is right about that. And we could reuse it here. Or if you wanted to dispose of it, okay, if people are worried about the risk of nuclear waste poses to people on Earth, the worst thing you could do is put it in a flight vehicle and launch it, because then it could crash and get spread around. The simplest way to dispose of nuclear waste, if that's what you want to do, is to glassify it into borosilicate glass so it's not water-soluble, put it in stainless steel cans, take it out to the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and drop it down into the seabed, and falling through the ocean, it will hit the mud and it'll tunnel about 100 meters down into the mud in sediments that have been stable for over 100 million years, at which point it's not going anywhere. That's called subseabed of disposal of nuclear waste. And the Carter administration banned it, and then Greenpeace drove an international treaty to ban it, because instead they went, the Carter administration went for a much more elaborate program of land-based disposal, costing billions of dollars, and in fact they never opened the facility. However, a land-based facility does exist for the U.S. military in New Mexico, and they've been disposing of nuclear waste there by putting it in salt formations for decades. In other words, the disposal of nuclear waste is technically a solved problem, okay? It's only been blocked. The so-called environmentalists have blocked the commercial nuclear industry from disposing of their waste, forcing it to store it in cooling ponds next to their nuclear power plants in order to maximize the danger to the public posed by nuclear waste. That is right. The Sierra Club, okay, which when it, in 1974, decided to turn against nuclear power, identified waste disposal as a way to, by blocking waste disposal, they could wreck the industry by imposing an expense on it and making it appear as dangerous to the public as possible. Okay, and so then they scream about the danger of disposing of nuclear waste under Yucca Mountain in Nevada, because after the next ice age, the mountain might be scraped away and the nomads roaming the territory where Nevada once was might run into nuclear waste. Instead, they prefer to keep it stored in suburbs of a major American cities because they want to maximize the apparent risk and to damage the industry. Completely fine.
David, does your dog have anything else to say?
Thank you very much for the clarification. So if you want to do nuclear on Mars, you should probably go with fusion.
Well, initially you go with fission because we have it now. But eventually fusion will be the way to go on Mars because, first of all, deuterium, which is the fuel for fusion, is six times as common on Mars as it is on Earth. The method of separating deuterium from heavy hydrogen is a one-step process. It's much simpler than producing uranium fuel or thorium fuel for nuclear fission reactors, so it requires a less complex industrial base. And furthermore, fusion could become the basis for interplanetary spaceships with much greater capabilities than anything we now have. So if the Martians are developing fusion for their own use and for developing commerce into the outer solar system, I think the Martians want fusion.
David, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate
thank
your
you.
Improvement. Bye-bye.
Let me just add one thing to that.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Steam engines were developed in England, but steam boats were first developed in the early United States. Okay, Robert Fulton. Okay, and in the process of developing steam boats, they were forced to develop steam engines that operated at a much higher pressure and efficiency than those that were adequate to pump water out of mines in England. So, in fact, the steam engine was made a practical technology when it was repackaged as a method of transportation, and then, of course, there were railroads after that, which were even more compact than steamboat engines. But and here's another thing. Nuclear power was only made efficient and only is dominant today in submarine propulsion. In other words, there's lots of ways that you can generate kilowatts to power a city. And nuclear power is one of them, but it has to compete with all these other. There's no other way right now to power a submarine, which is remotely as compares to a nuclear submarine. And similarly, fusion, you're going to develop fusion for electricity on Earth, but once again, it will compete with coal and solar and wind and hydroelectric and all these other things. But a fusion-powered spacecraft can have an exhaust velocity up to 7% the speed of light. Okay, there's nothing to compare with it. And so it may very well be that fusion is first developed and becomes a premier method of propulsion for spacecraft and then makes its way into the grid. Because once again, to the user of the grid, the kilowatt's a kilowatt. But to a spacecraft, just as to a nuclear submarine, a much more advanced method of propulsion cannot be matched. You can't power a spacecraft with a waterfall.
Bob, I have a curious question about our fusion industry. So I do follow it, and we do from time to time shows with it. And I know some of the entrepreneurial independent fusion companies are doing some pretty great things with deuterium and related powers. And some of them are coming up on break even, maybe. But then when you look at what the governments are doing with ITER, it's a totally different story. There's a disconnect here. Can you explain that one to me?
Sure. It's easy to explain. It's exactly the same thing that we've seen in space. Okay. And in fact, the entrepreneurial fusion revolution, the driver for it, even though he isn't involved in fusion at all himself, is Elon Musk. Okay. That is, Musk is not a fusion guy. Musk is into solar energy. But the, what he did with SpaceX was prove that it is possible for a well-led entrepreneurial team to do things in, you know, one-tenth the money, one-third the time that had previously been thought necessary by the mainstream space industry, and even do things that they had deemed entirely possible, like reusable launch vehicles. And so investors took a look at that, and they said, huh, maybe the problem with fusion is not fundamentally technical. Maybe it's institutional. Maybe what's needed here is an entrepreneurial approach. And so you started to get fusion entrepreneurs getting big investors, hundreds of millions of dollars, okay? And these teams are not operating on 50-year schedules like ITER, okay? They're operating on 5-year schedules. And I'm convinced we're going to see fusion ignition this decade, and it will be done by one of these entrepreneurial fusion companies. They will do it before ITER even turns on, even though ITER project was started in the mid-80s.
You do have a caller waiting on hold. Let me take the call, and then I've got some emails for you about when we can expect searching for life. But hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall out in Oklahoma.
Okay.
And earlier you were talking about, contamination of Earth by Martian microbes. And my usual comment is, that's why we're going to have a moon base, is so that we can bring back all the Mars samples we want and do all the testing and all the risky stuff on the moon. And that kind of flies with most people. Do you find that to be an easy way out that most people accept?
Some people might accept it, but actually all the sample return scientists are 100% against that, because the entire point of the Mars sample return is to bring samples to Earth so they can be sent out to 1,000 university labs to be examined by thousands of investigators using thousands of different kinds of instruments. I mean, that's the entire point of the sample return. And say we're going to send it to the moon or to the gateway orbiting the moon is totally sabotages the mission. And in fact, if that's the ground rules for the mission, there shouldn't be such a mission. We should just get instruments to Mars and look at all the different rocks on Mars with whatever instruments we could send to Mars.
Yes, but if you take the samples and spread them to thousands of universities around the world for the big diplomatic thing, there's going to be contamination. Wait a minute,
no,
that's exactly what you're trying to prevent.
Because there's no contamination that's going to come from Martian rocks. And the scientists know that. But the entire point of the sample return is to get the rocks into the hands of large numbers of scientific groups on Earth. That is the reason for the sample return mission. If you're not going to do that, there is no reason to do the sample return mission.
Okay, well, I'd like to have a discussion on IETR, but you've probably heard them all, and you probably come to the same conclusion I have. So I'll just say thank you for the info, and next time.
Thank you, Marco.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
So, listen, I do want to bring up something.
Okay.
Right now, the Mars Society is engaged in a unique project, okay? And you know that before I went to graduate school to become an engineer, I spent a number of years as a secondary school science and math teacher. Okay, so I entered graduate school after having been a teacher. And in an engineering curriculum, either graduate or undergraduate, in almost any good university engineering program, they have what they call a design class. And the design class is totally different from a conventional class. It is, you get the whole class and you organize it to design some complex engineering systems. So, for instance, in aerospace, you might be assigned to design a fighter aircraft of a new kind. And it has to meet a variety of requirements, speed, ceiling, armaments, range, cost, okay, survivability. And you get different groups organized within the class. One is a propulsion group, one's an aerodynamics group, one is, you know, a structures group, and armaments group. And you try to design it, and in general, maximizing any one of these qualities takes away from the others. And so you have to work out the best possible compromise, you know, because extra armaments means less mass for propulsion, okay? Extra armaments or more propulsion interferes with the aerodynamic cleanliness of the plane. Improving anything almost always increases cost. So, you know, that's what it is. And so it's a group project. And then so it's a creative exercise done as a group. And frequently different universities all try to design the same thing. And then their teams come and they compete in a design competition. Now, encountering this in graduate school, and having had experience as a teacher, I said, this would be a great way to teach science in high school. Instead of just lecturing people and telling the kids you have to know all this for the test, have them do a design class. So the Mars Society this summer has organized an international high school design class to design a human mission to Mars. And we actually have five teams, one from Asia, one from Europe, one from the eastern U.S., the central U.S., and the western U.S. And some of those teams also have Canadians in them in the same time zone. So it's North American teams that from those zones. Anyway, and they're charged with designing a Mars mission, and it's and the surface part of the mission, they're assumed that they have the capability to deliver 30 tons and up to 6 people to the surface of Mars, design the mission to achieve the maximum possible science return. Okay, so you've got this much mass, how much you're going to spend on vehicles, how much are you going to spend on crew consumables? You can have up to 6 crew, but if you have 4 crew, you won't have much consumables. You might be able to take more equipment. So forth and so on. You can choose where you want to go, identify the landing site, and then take appropriate equipment. And so the teams are rated for, and they can stay up to a year and a half, or they can cut the mission shorter to reduce the amount of consumables and thus increase the amount of equipment. There's a lot of ways to trade this. And so we have these teams, and So they had 2 weeks of lectures that we, of all sorts of prominent experts in either Mars science or engineering that we had. We had Benner spoke to them. David Poston, the developer of the Kilo Power Reactor, spoke to them. Chris McKay, astrobiologist, spoke to them. So forth, about 20 lecturers. So they got 2 weeks of background and then were invited to read, and then 2 weeks to design, and then a week to write up reports, and then this week they've been presenting their studies, but then we added an additional element, okay, which is debate, because on Monday all the teams presented their design. Today, all the teams, each team was given a half hour to criticize the other team's designs, okay, to try to point out weaknesses. And tomorrow, all the teams are going to have a chance to defend their designs against the rebuttals, because in the real world, engineering is a contact sport. Your designs are always being criticized by your rivals, by your competitors, and you have to defend them. So that's what we're doing, and it's proving amazing. The kids produced incredible designs. I would say all the designs produced by the kids are superior to NASA's current design reference mission, because that mission is not science-driven. It misses out on the entire purpose of sending missions to Mars. These kids are designing their missions around the concept of trying to maximize the science return. And so it's great stuff. And, it's all there on, if you can go to our website, there's a link. You can actually see the presentations of the students. You can see their reports. You can see the criticisms they launched today against the other students. And tomorrow, after tomorrow, we'll be able to see their responses to the criticisms. But this is a totally new kind of pedagogy, because, you know, it reverses the relationship of the students to knowledge. Right now, the student's knowledge is a burden. How much of this do we need to know for the test? Whereas when you're tasked in this way, then knowledge becomes a treasure. There must be a better way to do this. I'm going to read into the literature. I'm going to find out how people have thought of doing this. I'm going to try to find a better way to do this. It's an astonishing thing. And we're going to publish all the design reports as a book. And the winning team is also going to present at our conference, which is going to be in October in Tempe, Arizona. So you'll get to see the kids themselves showing off the work they did, and you'll be amazed, absolutely floored, that this was done by high school students.
Who judges it? How do you determine who the winners are?
Okay, well, what's happening is this. We have about 10 judges who've been watching read the reports, watching all the presentations, and then each team is being rated based on its written report, on its verbal presentation, and on its rebuttal to the criticisms. They're not being rated on their criticisms. They're being rated on how well they defended themselves against the criticisms, and they're going to get 30 points for science, 30 points for the soundness of their engineering, 30 points for how well they dealt with the challenges to humans on the crew, the human issues, and 10 points for cost. And we only had 10 points for cost because cost is very hard to evaluate in these kinds of mission designs. And furthermore, most of the cost of the mission is going to be the same, because we're assuming they all have the same transportation system and they've gotten 30 tons to the surface of Mars. And so the extra costs for whether you're using rovers or helicopters or something is the minor part of the whole mission cost. But basically, if somebody has come up with an excessive number of vehicle or aircraft or designs or just too many different things, then it's assumed that the costs are going to be higher. And one of the teams found a way to reduce costs by generating income, so it's going to get a little extra in that category. But most of the judging is based on science accomplished, the soundness of the engineering, and how it dealt with the human challenges.
The listeners, I'll put the links to this in their YouTube channel in the summary of the space show. But if anyone has that and wants to post it on the blog, please go ahead and do it. What were you going to say, Bob?
And once again, if there are any teachers listening to this show, I urge you to take a very good look at this and see how you could implement this methodology in your classroom, because this is a revolutionary way to teach.
Absolutely. Maybe some teachers are listening and they'll call in tonight. So, listeners, if you do want to call in tonight, our telephone is 866-687-7223. And email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. I've got a couple of emails for you, Bob.
Okay.
Sherry is in Boston, and she says, Bob, given the status of looking for life on Mars, which seems to be a status quo status, is there any kind of timeline that you think is plausible where we might actually start a bona fide search for life on Mars?
Well, frankly, at this point, I think it's most likely to come by SpaceX breaking the mold. They're being stalled by bureaucracy in terms of getting permission to start testing the Starship launch. But eventually, that will be cleared up, I'm pretty sure. And I think Starship will be regularly flying to orbit by 2024, okay?
Uh-huh.
And so now think about this for a minute, the situation. We're going to have an election in 2024, and somebody's going to be elected president. And I don't think it's likely to be either Trump or Biden, by the way, although either of those are theoretically possible. But someone's going to be elected president. And if the Starship is a reality, things delivering 100-ton payloads to Earth orbit, you know, comparable to Saturn V launch, but 1% the cost because it's reusable. If that's the world we're living in the year 2024, whoever's elected is going to turn to his or her advisors and say, look, here's this guy that wants to send humans to Mars, and he's got the ships already. If we get together with him, could we have people on Mars by the end of my second term? And the answer is going to be yes. And they say, well, is it going to cost $1 trillion? No, it can probably be done within NASA's existing budget. There's a bunch of stuff he doesn't have that's new. They need Mars spacesuits, vehicles, ISRU systems, a nuclear reactor. We can develop that part. And by coming together with them, we can make this happen within NASA's budget within the next 8 years. And they said, well, then why aren't we doing this? In other words, by making this thing feasible, by making it practical, Musk is going to make it sellable. And so it's going to happen. And once you start sending humans to Mars, your capability for doing all kinds of science on Mars, including the most important science, which is the search for life, will be enormously improved. Enormously improved.
And you don't think the regulations will stop it or try to...
The regulations will be changed when someone really wants to do it. Okay? That's how this is going to work. And, I mean, look, you know, Starship... it represents a tremendous exploration capability. It also represents a tremendous national security capability, okay?
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, this war in Ukraine right now is really a space war, okay? It is. The only reason why the Ukrainians are being able to hold off Russia is because of precision-guided weapons, which are based on GPS satellites, okay? And, you know, like that cruiser that they sank, the Moskva, 2 precision-guided missiles. They didn't send a giant barrage of things, and 2 of which happened to hit the Moskva. They sent 2 rockets, and they both hit, and they sank the thing. And the ability to do that, to dominate space, it massively multiplies the firepower of whatever is on the ground. And the, the Russians have 10 times the nominal firepower, but Ukraine can soar just as many hits because they've got precision-guided weapons. Well, if there was a real war between the U.S. and either Russia or China, it would be determined by who has control of space. And now here's the thing. The Russians, the Chinese, they're both developing ASATs to destroy our satellites. And if there was a war, they would destroy a lot of our satellites. And the ability of us to maintain our space assets will depend on our ability to rapidly replace them. And, well, you can see even with Falcons, Musk is launching 60 or so communication satellites at a time, single launch.
Right.
Well, with Starship, which can do twice what a Falcon Heavy can do, and presumably do it cheaper because it's completely reusable, you know, this is how you would be able to sustain our forces. So it would be absolutely nuts, okay, from the standpoint of people who might not care about at all about sending humans to Mars, but care a lot about U.S. national security, to allow this blocking of Starship development to continue. It is fundamental national security asset that we have is our superior space launch capability, which Starship would really enhance. It's important to us today as the British Navy was to Britain in its day. And, so Starship's going to happen. It's going to happen. The U.S. national security depends on it. The security of the Western world depends on it. And once Starship happens, then the fact that that will make humans to Mars a very practical thing. And then the politicians will decide, I want to be the one that does that.
You have another note from Tim in Huntsville. Number one, when do you predict a Starship landing on Mars, and how large will the crew be? And number two, what are your thoughts on the James Webb Telescope?
Well, I think Starship will land on Mars probably this decade or certainly by 2032. In other words, I think that we're going to have, once Starship becomes a reality, it will become extremely attractive to a president to make it his or her business to get this done within their terms of office. So that's what I would say. Within around 10 years, we will have people on Mars. I don't think we're going to send 100 people. I actually don't think that Elon Musk's vision of how you'd colonize Mars just by sending hundreds of starships with hundreds of people each and trying to just deliver a million people to Mars is how it would go at all. I think initially we'll have exploration missions, and then we'll build a modest base. So initial mission might be 10 people, and then we'll build up a base with 100 people, and the base will start building greenhouses and stuff, so you'll have the ability to produce food on Mars. And the more things you build on Mars, more in situ resource capability systems that are there to produce food, to produce glass, to produce steel, so you can make more greenhouses and grow more food, then it will be possible to send larger and larger complements to Mars. If we were doing, Mars Direct, where, frankly, we're doing the mission with a launch vehicle not unlike the current SLS, which, in fact, is based on the REs that we designed for Mars Direct in 1988. Great vehicle for the 1990s. Now it's already obsolete before it has flown. But there we're talking four people. I think the Starships probably will send 10, 12, something like that on initial missions. If you're going to Mars with Starships. And then they'll get more. Then you'll send 20. Then you'll send 50. But there's no need to have 100 people on exploration missions to Mars. And you want to send some explorers first to set up the facility to help support larger numbers to follow. And then there was another question. Oh, Webb.
Webb, yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I did not agree with all those people that were complaining about the Webb overruns. There's a problem with overruns. But fundamentally, Webb is a great program. And the reason why Webb is a great program and Space Station was not is because Webb is a science-driven program. Webb is a purpose-driven program, okay? It has clear objectives. And given the magnificent capability that was created, no one 10 years from now, let alone 100 years from now, is going to be looking at how much Webb cost. They're going to be looking at the discoveries that it made. Okay, whereas the space station costs vastly more, and what have we learned from it? Because it is a vendor-driven program. The shuttle was mostly a vendor-driven program. The shuttle program never had clear objectives. A few shuttle missions, like the Hubble launch, repair, and upgrade missions did. So if all the shuttle missions, all 130 or so shuttle missions, had been as worthwhile as those five, then the shuttle program would have been the greatest science program in human history. Okay? But since most of the shuttle missions were flying the shuttle just to fly the shuttle, let's see if we can get six this year without any actual purpose, that program was waste. So the fundamental issue with NASA programs is not how good the design is, but if they're designing the right thing. Does the mission have a purpose? Webb has a clear purpose. It's a purpose-driven program, not a vendor-driven program. And so, like Hubble, it's going to go down in the book as one of the crowns, one of the jewels in NASA's crown.
You have another caller who wants to talk to you. Good evening, caller. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Hi. Welcome back. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Can you hear me okay?
Perfect.
Yes.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, worried about my cell phone. So,
me too.
First, I wanted to thank you for all your efforts on fostering Mars exploration and settlement. And I really appreciate all the efforts you've done over the years, Robert. And I've been rooting for you all the way. I have a few questions regarding the human gravity prescription, and specifically with respect to reproduction. And I've never heard you address it, but I heard a rumor recently that some years ago you actually approached Elon Musk with a protocol to study the gravity prescription in space, but he didn't pursue it. And I was just wondering if this was true, first of all, and was the protocol designed to study mammalian reproduction?
Yes. It's true. The Mars Society back in 2000 came up with, following the success building of the Flashline Mars Arctic Research Station in the Arctic, you know, we gained credibility at that point. We had actually delivered on a project, which is something rare among space advocacy organizations and space visionaries. We built the Mars practice station in the Arctic, and now we wanted to take the next step, use that credibility to do a space mission. And what we identified was this as a key issue not being investigated by either the American or foreign space agencies, which is the issue of, partial gravity and also artificial gravity. And we came up with a design for a mission which we called the TransLife mission. And we actually held an engineering design contest where a number of universities entered it. Eventually MIT won with their design for this mission, which they then renamed the Mars Gravity Mission. And one of the leaders, the two leaders of that were Paul Wooster and Erica Wagner. Paul Wooster is now head of Mars Mission Design for SpaceX, and Erica Wagner is one of the top managers at Blue Origin. But anyway, the idea of the TransLife mission was to send a capsule into Earth orbit with a crew of mice, and this would be a spinning capsule. So imagine something looking kind of like an Apollo capsule, but smaller, about 1 meter diameter, spinning, so you would have Mars gravity in it, and you'd have a crew of mice, and they'd fly for 60 days, during which time they would reproduce, and the youngsters would grow to maturity, and then it would be brought back down to Earth. And then we would have a chance to see both how mammals born and raised on Earth how they thrive in one-third gravity, and how their children born and raised in one-third gravity developed. Okay, and this would be the first data anyone had ever done. Okay, in fact, the only artificial gravity experiment that had ever been done on mammals in space was a Soviet experiment in 1977, where they had some rats in a spinner that was doing 1G, and that was basically as a control against some other rats that were in 0G. They were not investigating partial gravity at all. So this was fundamental. And then when Elon Musk came to our fundraiser in Silicon Valley in 2001, I approached him and with this concept to ask him to fund it. He was nowhere near as rich then as he is now. I think he was worth a couple of $100 million, so he's literally 1,000 times more wealthy now than he was then. But he had some money, for sure. And I hooked him up with Jim Cantrell, who I knew, because they wanted to get a launch vehicle, and Cantrell had done a lot of dealings with the Russians. And at that time, your cheapest launch vehicles that were being marketed in Russia, ex-Soviet assets. And they went over there, and everyone that Musk tried to deal with was trying to swindle him. And he just got sick of it. He can smell a swindle a mile away, and he said, I'm not putting up with this. And he went back, and he decided to start his own launch vehicle company called SpaceX. And Cantrell was his first chief engineer. Subsequently, they had a parting of ways, and Cantrell went off to start Vector Space and then Phantom Rockets. We're just doing stuff now. But anyway, that's how this all began. So we didn't get the TransLife mission, but it led to SpaceX. So there you go.
Well, that's a win, I would say.
Yes, huge win.
Well, so would you support a variable gravity facility in low Earth orbit to answer that question as soon as possible?
Would I support a variable gravity thing? Well, sure, I would still support the TransLife mission. Of course, data on mice is not as good as data on humans. Orion, you know, is way over-designed and overweight for use in lunar missions. But it's easy enough to launch to low Earth orbit, and I think it could make a great temporary space station. That is, if you took an Orion with a crew in it, and you launch it to Earth orbit, and then you tethered off the upper stage of the launch vehicle that delivered it to Earth orbit, and you spin it up, you spin up the tethered assembly, you could create artificial gravity in the Orion. You could create lunar gravity. You could create Mars gravity. And you could see how well humans do in partial gravity. The problem, though, has been, and, you know, we originally proposed TransLife to NASA, and there were some supporters, particularly at NASA Ames Research Center. But the mainstream, the NASA space medical community, is controlled by zero-gravity health effects researchers. And that's why NASA has never done any research on artificial gravity. I mean, they, not on mice, not on people, not on nothing. Because, frankly, artificial gravity would basically steal the bowl of rice of the current NASA space medicine community, which is zero-gravity health effects research. So, in fact, you know, NASA wants to send Mars astronauts to Mars in zero-G, and I once asked them about this. This was actually before the space station was built. And I said, why are you sending astronauts to Mars in zero-G? It's going to weaken them. They won't be able to do as effective exploration. They say, well, all our data on human space flight is going to be zero-G because we're building the space station zero-G. And I said, why are you building the space station zero-G? Because we're going to go to Mars zero-G.
Yeah, I understand your frustration. But for long-term planning, if we want to settle Mars, we need to understand if we can have children on Mars. And so if we determine with one of these facilities, and I think Musk could probably fund one and probably will ahead of NASA, Do you think if we find out that humans cannot reproduce in Mars gravity levels, that the long-term strategy for space settlement might change and we might consider alternatives such as O'Neill-type colonies that spin at 1G?
Well, it's O'Neill colonies. O'Neill colony, I mean, even the worst NASA Mars mission design is like 1,000 tons to orbit. O'Neill colony is a million times more difficult project than going to Mars.
Well, it would be smaller at first, obviously.
No, I think O'Neill colonies are off the wall. But really, at least for the next, say, 300 years or so. Frankly, I think it's very unlikely because you want to know something? Embryos develop in zero G because they develop in a buoyant environment. Okay? So, I don't think that 1/3 G is going to harm them. Now, I do think 1/3 G will affect the development of children, and you'll probably have to deal with that with appropriate exercise programs and adults as well to make sure that there is not physical deterioration based on inadequate exercise and stress. But look, this is something that I agree should be researched. But you know, do you know that there were actually people who argued in Europe that people might not be able to develop adequately in the new world?
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, they did. And they argued that the animals here were not as good as the animals in the old world because this was an inferior world.
Yeah, but they also said we couldn't go 40 miles an hour in a train, and we couldn't go supersonic, and we couldn't go in an airplane, that humans couldn't do a lot of things.
Yes, exactly. And but ultimately, the test will be in the doing. I mean, in other words, I can tell you what I think is likely to happen, but we should do the research, and the research can be done on orbit, or ultimately, you can find out the answer by when you go to Mars and you see what happens.
On the job training.
Yep, that's what a lot of people think. I'll clear the line. Thank you so much, Robert, for all your efforts, and I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Hey, listen, I want to talk a bit about the Mars Society Conference.
I was just going to ask you to do that because we're past the hour mark, so go ahead, yeah.
Right. So the Mars Society is having its next international conference at Arizona State University, which is in Tempe, Arizona, which is a suburb of Phoenix. And this is the first in-person conference we've had since COVID. That is, we had two totally Zoom conferences in 2020 and 2021. So this time we're coming back in person and in Arizona. Most of the speakers will be there in person. A few will be participating by Zoom, but we got some really great speakers. And the theme is searching for life with heavy lift. Because once again, while the planetary protection people are saying if we want to do science on Mars, we can't send people, we're saying if you want to do science on Mars, the best possible way to do it is to send people, and that means heavy lift. And even before we send people, we can use heavy lift to send large-scale robotic expeditions. And by the way, that is the other design contest the Mars Society sponsored this year. That is an international conference with a significant cash prize to design a telerobotic Mars mission, I believe, with 10 tons of assumed payload. Now, 10 tons is 10 times the mass of the Curiosity rover. So you could send several rovers, or you could send a whole fleet of rovers of a variety of sizes. You could send helicopters. You could have a static lab on Mars to bring the samples to. You can do all sorts of things. In other words, if you have heavy lift capability that is in the range needed for delivering a human mission, it can deliver a gigantic robotic expedition. And one way to exercise that landing system would be to land robotic expedition first. And so that's what the current contest is. But we're also going to have speakers there, including Steve Benner, who I mentioned, is going to speak there. And we're really, you know, in other words, look, you want to do science on Mars and you got heavy lift? What's the right way to do science? Okay, and it's certainly not to spend, you know, a decade and a half to do a sample return mission to bring back, you know, a couple of kilograms of samples and send it to the lunar gateway. That's not the way to do it. So we're going to talk about this, and we're basically going to turn the argument on its head. That is, we're going to take on, if we say doing science on Mars, look searching for life on Mars, which is the real science that needs to be done on Mars. If you're serious about that, you got to be serious about human exploration.
And what are the actual dates again on the conference?
I believe it's October 20th through 23rd. The call for papers, by the way, is still open. You can upload an abstract, a 300-word abstract, and get a chance to speak at the conference on any issue relating to the exploration or settlement to Mars. That's anything from an instrument to be used on the next robotic mission to Mars to what you think the political system of a Mars city state should be. Okay, and anything in between, human Mars mission designs, propulsion system designs, terraforming concepts, you name it, we're going to talk about it. And we're certainly going to talk about this planetary protection issue. You know, I met with Musk in 2020, and I said to him, what can we do to help you? And he said, you've got to take down the planetary protection thing. Because unless that's taken down, nobody's going to Mars.
And how do you propose doing that?
We have to do it by going after them in public debate. We have to challenge everything they say. We have to refute them. People need to write articles. People need to, if they have access to media, to use the media. Use Twitter. Use anything you've got. Write a screenplay. I mean, these people need to be refuted, debunked, disgraced.
Are they?
And basically, you've got to tell NASA, okay, we want a space program that's really going somewhere. And you say you want to send humans to Mars, you have to remove these regulations that you have put in place that would forbid you or anyone else from going to Mars.
Do they do public debate on this? Do they will they engage people?
Public debate.
Excuse me?
We have to challenge them. Challenge them to public debate, have a chair there for them, and if they don't show up, debate the chair.
You have another caller on the call. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Okay.
Yeah. Earlier on, you were talking about the fusion for space flight, and that's been an idea that I'd had a long time ago, is that fusion and space flight might become practical more than as an economical energy source on Earth. And I think you're sort of agreeing with that idea.
Well, it's one possible way of how this can evolve. In other words, nuclear power has had mixed luck in competing for a commercial power generation. Okay, it's been very successful in France. It's 75% of the grid. In the U.S., it's 20%. But in submarine propulsion, there's no competition because it's not just a question of price. A nuclear-powered submarine can circle the world underwater. A diesel-powered submarine has got to, with using batteries while it's underwater, has got to come up in 24 hours. So they're just totally different animals. And so fusion as a power system is going to have to compete with all sorts of established technologies. Fusion as a propulsion system is absolutely unique. You cannot power a spacecraft with a windmill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So, well, and you could conceivably have the highest specific impulses that way, too, practically. So,
yes, you can get the highest possible specific impulse.
The other thought that occurred to me is, what the kind of fuel that you would use in an Earth-based system and what you'd likely want to use in space might not be the same thing. It occurs to me that deuterium-tritium is a normal thing, like the heater ITER planet would be. But here you probably would want something like helium-3 and deuterium would be better because your output would be primarily charged particles, which would be easier to convert into a propulsion thrust.
Well, that's true. Now, deuterium helium-3 also has attractions for use on the ground because it, once again, the power is producing charged particles, which can be converted to electricity at very high efficiency, and also it has very little neutron emission, which means very little radioactive waste. That is, there's no fission waste from fusion, but if you have, for instance, a steel reactor, neutrons can make it medium-level radioactive. But if you have very few neutrons, then that's greatly reduced. So helium-3 is attractive. Now, lower cost would be pure deuterium, which also has less neutrons than deuterium-tritium and is simpler, that you don't have to have a lithium breeding blanket to breed tritium. But deuterium-helium-3 is a real winner for spacecraft, yes.
Yeah, the thing on that is that is getting your helium-3, which is a rare thing to get. And one thought occurred to me is if you had a of course, this would kind of contradict what I was saying earlier, but if you did have Earth-based fusion going for commercial, and you could also, produce an excess amount of tritium, perhaps you could take the tritium and put it into some kind of a fusion-like plasma device, only don't try to fuse it, just put pure tritium in it and just bounce them against each other and maybe induce radioactive decay down to helium-3. I wonder, does that sound like something that could work?
With a half-life of 11 years to helium-3.
Yeah, well, yeah, if it just does spawn, does naturally, just like fermenting them, just let them go. But what if you actually put them at plasma temperatures, and bounce them into each other?
I don't think you can accelerate radioactive decay. Although you should know, you've got a great predecessor with that idea, which is H.G. Wells, in his book, The World Set Free, which was written before there was nuclear fission, but which they did know about radioactivity, he speculated on accelerating radioactive decay to create a massive power source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are interesting ideas, anyhow. I don't know. Deuterium is an interesting idea because you would be breeding your helium-3 and your tritium both at the same time. And while deuterium would produce very little energy, relatively speaking, but it would be, it would take energy in just to make the reaction work. The output of it, the waste products, would then fuse in the deuterium mix and would create a more energy, maybe.
If you're having a deuterium-deuterium reactor, the reactions produce tritium and helium-3, which would react immediately in the plasma themselves because they'd be surrounded with deuterium, which is what they both want to react with, and they're more reactive than the deuterium. So you get what's called the catalyzed DD reaction, which, at the end of the day, the basic reaction, what goes in and what goes out, is deuterium. Just deuterium is going in, and what's coming out is helium-4s and protons and a few neutrons.
Yeah. That would be the ideal thing, wouldn't it? Because it would be more available and also stable. Anyway, I just thought those are interesting concepts, but that doesn't look like there's a lot of research going to really develop that yet.
Well, they're trying to get ignition with deuterium-tritium because it's the easiest. But back in the day when I was in this field, I did a study, and I showed that if you have a deuterium-tritium reactor, you can... If you have just a little bit better confinement than is needed for ignition, you can use that to ramp the temperature of the system up from 10 kilovolts to like 60 kilovolts, which is where deuterium-deuterium will go. So in other words, you basically use the tritium as lighter fluid and you get it up to the zone where the DD reaction will occur.
Yeah, very interesting. It's around 60 kilovolts. That's where you want to do that for the deuterium reaction then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Thanks a lot. I thought it's getting a little technical for most of the, but I just thought I'd talk to you about it since you know that stuff. Very interesting show.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
I got an email from Pamela in Chicago, and she says, "Bob, will you tell us why you got this interest in Mars and you're so interested in getting to Mars?"
And what about these upcoming missions going to Venus? Do you think we might get an interest in seeing if we can't get humans to the upper atmosphere areas of Venus? Would that compete with Mars?
Okay, well, I've been interested in space since 1957. I was 5 when Sputnik flew, and while the adults may have been terrified of it, I was very exhilarated by it because it meant that all these science fiction stories that I was reading about space travel were going to happen.
Right.
And then as I read into space, by the time I was 10 or so, it was clear to me that Mars was by far the most interesting planet. It was the one that could have life, and it was the one that was most favorable for settlement. So basically I've been on to Mars ever since then. Now Venus, I don't see sending humans to Venus. There's nothing for humans to do at Venus. That is, you can send probes floating into Venus's atmosphere. You certainly could do that. You can fly balloons in the Venus atmosphere, pretty easily. But there's nothing humans could. Humans are needed on Mars because it's a planet with a rocky surface. There are things for people to do there. You want to send people to places where you can exploit human abilities. But I don't see humans doing anything. You can't go to the surface of Venus. It's too hot. You could float in the, 50 kilometers above the surface, and the temperatures are in an acceptable range, and the atmospheric pressure actually is in an acceptable range. But there's nothing for people to do. So I don't see people going to Venus. I am interested in probes going to Venus. There's been some interesting chemistry discovered in Venus's atmosphere that some people think could be biological signatures. I'm not prepared to judge that. I intuitively think it's unlikely, but, the most exciting thing in science is when you run into things that are unlikely. So that's when you learn something. So I'm all for sending probes to Venus, especially I'd like to fly balloons in Venus's atmosphere. But I don't see sending people to Venus.
Here's a question for Jack. This may be the final one of the evening because we're actually approaching 90 minutes, and I know this is going to be variable. Jack is in Lincoln, Nebraska. I don't hear from Lincoln all that often. And he says, I'd really like your opinion on should we or should we not be concerned or fearful about the Chinese space program and their plans on getting to the moon?
Well, really, I don't think we should be fearful of China getting to the moon. I think we should be fearful of a situation where we are going so slow that China gets to the moon before us and in a greater, quantity that most of the human activity on the moon is Chinese. It won't be the Chinese's fault if that's the case. It'll be our fault, okay? Mm-hmm. That is, look, we're competing with China, but you're not going to hold back China. The issue here is whether we're going to untie our chains that we have put on ourselves, okay? Because if America and the West allow China to emerge as the preeminent global civilization, and there's some real problems with that because they've got the very different ideas on human freedom than we do. And it's not just the government. It's what the people themselves see as normative and what the culture sees. And if this happens, it won't be because of them. It'll be because of us. Okay? We have what should be, what has been in the past, a far more innovative culture than them. During the 60s, the Russians started out ahead of us in space, but we just showed them what a free society could do. And now we're floundering. If we sabotage SpaceX, here's SpaceX, a vastly superior space capability. If it doesn't happen, it will be because we sabotaged it. Not because we weren't capable of it. And, you know, there are groups in China right now that are working very hard on duplicating the Falcon 9. And my guess is by mid-20s, they will have a vehicle comparable to the Falcon 9. Okay? And if we haven't gone beyond the Falcon 9 by then, that's not their fault. That's our fault. So, yes, China's a challenge, and the way to deal with it is to set ourselves free.
Are you optimistic?
Well, yeah, I'm a pretty optimistic guy. I think, you know, America was pretty screwed up in the 1930s, and then we were hit at Pearl Harbor, and we got our act together. And, you know, and then we were hit with Sputnik, and we got our act together. You know, we've been floundering on Ukraine, but the Biden administration is gradually getting its act together. Sure, they should have been sending Ukraine massive amounts of arms while Putin was threatening it. We could have deterred the whole invasion, and this whole disaster wouldn't have happened. But I think that people are beginning to realize that we can't choose to lose. This is too important, okay? We cannot choose to lose to China either, okay? And so I think we're going to start to get serious. You know, here, Biden came into office, and his first goal was to wreck the U.S. oil industry, shut down the Keystone Pipeline, first on the agenda. And then all of a sudden they realized, you know, if we're not producing oil, and then oil gets more expensive, that will fund Russia, and we'll be hit by high gas prices, so we're going to be taxed to fund our enemies. Huh. Maybe we have to change this policy.
Well, but they haven't changed it yet. So.
Well, you know, they're beginning to change it. They're beginning to change on the nuclear issue. You know, here's the Germans, who are even stupider, right? They had a perfectly good nuclear industry, and they decide to shut it down because of what? Fukushima? Like Germany was going to be swept with tidal waves? Ridiculous. So here's the German Greens, also concerned about the existential threat of climate change, shutting down their nuclear reactors and replacing it with Russian gas and Polish coal.
Brilliant.
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 But now, finally, you know, for the first time, just, I think, last week, Schultz said, maybe we shouldn't shut down the last three nuclear reactors because the Russians are turning off the gas. What a surprise.
I was going to say, even Gavin Newsom is now trying to fight to not shut down the last nuclear reactor in California.
Right. You know,
so even your dog agrees with
reality
that.
Reality holds a stick. And sometimes reality can use this stick, hit hard enough to wake people up. And I think that America is still capable of waking up. So I'm an optimist.
Have we missed anything that you wanted to talk to us or talk with us about tonight?
Well, just a couple things. Number one, for people that are new, you know, if you want to read my ideas about Mars and space, I've got two pertinent books, The Case for Mars and The Case for Space. And I also have a humorous book called How to Live on Mars, which is a guide to Martian immigrants from an old hand. And then finally, once again, we're going to have this great conference near Phoenix, Arizona, October 20th through 23rd. The call for papers is still open. If you have any idea relevant to Mars exploration or settlement, submit an abstract. Or if you don't have an idea that you want to talk about, just come to the conference. It's going to be great.
Thank you, Bob. And we will talk to you later. And appreciate your coming back on the show and helping us to understand some complex issues.
All right. Thanks
for inviting. Talk to you soon. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Okay.
Listeners, thanks to Bob 100 times over. He's a great guest. But more than that, he really has his act together, in my opinion, and has very willingly shares a lot of his wisdom and ideas with us and answers questions. And I appreciate him being on the show, and hopefully you do as well. So that's our Tuesday night program. So Dr. Ben Arroyo is our guest tomorrow on some new developments that might influence lunar HABs on, well, lunar HABs would be lunar HABs. So hopefully our friend John Batchelor will get that program archived by the end of the week. Sometimes he drags on that, but I'm looking for Heim's show to be archived probably Thursday or Friday night, and it's going to be a Hotel Mar show you definitely want to hear. Friday, the Space Frontier Foundation's co-chair, Michelle DelValle, if I'm saying her name right, is coming on to talk about the New Space Conference. It's in Seattle later this month. And Sunday, Ryan Reynolds is going to talk about SSP, space settlement, and a bunch of other issues, and he's going to be a little controversial. And we hope you will participate and call in or email in or both and share in that particular conversation. So, again, special thanks to Bob and to all of you who called the show and sent in emails. I would say to keep looking up, but it's raining with a heavy thunderstorm where I am, so I'm not about to go look up right now. But for all of you, please do go look up. As always, and good night from Bob, David, all of the callers, the dog that was barking, I think that was Bob's dog, he's always welcome on the show, and everybody have a great week, it's just starting, stay safe, and have a good week, and think space, goodbye once again from the Space Show.